What I Have Learned. The fourth talk at Gutenberg College's 2014 Summer Institute and 20th Anniversary Celebration was presented by Chris Swanson on August 1, 2014. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Everybody, welcome. Thanks for coming. What I'm going to talk about today is Being Human Beings, A Physicist Looks at Aristotle. When I went to the University of Oregon, I went to study physics. I thought that at that time, I might like to try my hand at teaching physics at some small Christian liberal arts college. And therein lies deep irony. First, I find it ironic that although I did end up teaching at a small Christian liberal arts college, practically none of what I learned at the University of Oregon was pertinent to the role I play at Gutenberg College. Instead, I have read and learned alongside the students literature, history, economics, philosophy of science, philosophy of mathematics, and perhaps most interestingly, lots of Aristotle. I find it even more ironic that last year, for the first time, I read with the freshman microexegesis class Aristotle's Physics. And finally, I find it most ironic of all that the content of Aristotle's Physics is a profound critique of the unspoken view taught to me at the University of Oregon, and that I now find Aristotle's perspective far more compelling. Now, on the one hand, it must be admitted that what Aristotle was talking about is not the subject matter of a modern physics curriculum. A modern physics curriculum talks about forces and laws and equations, about inert matter. Aristotle was, in fact, ignorant of all those laws, and on the few occasions he did propose law-like relationships, he was pretty much completely wrong. Score one for the modern physicist. Furthermore, Aristotle was not an experimentalist in the modern sense. He did not design experiments and test theories. He never timed the swing of a single pendulum. Lucky him. Nor calculated speeds or forces. He had neither calculus nor calculators to aid his endeavors. His studies were rather limited. Score two for modern physics. Instead, he was a keen observer. He observed the world around him, and from those observations, he drew conclusions. And part of the world that most interested him was the world of living things, and in particular, man. And an issue of great interest to Aristotle about man was what a man is. What does it mean to be a human being? And in his observations and musings about being a human being, he rejected, rightly in my opinion, some of the key foundational assumptions of modern physics. Score one for Aristotle. To explore his views and the question of what it means to be a human being, I, following Aristotle, am going to make some observations. I do not have lots of data to back up my claims. I have not done statistical analyses, nor have I conducted carefully crafted surveys. I have no peer-reviewed articles to prove my claims. Nevertheless, I think that a great deal of progress can be made on this question using an Aristotelian approach. So without further ado, let us ask, what did Aristotle say? First, Aristotle discussed what it means for a thing to exist. What makes a thing at all? What makes a pen a pen? Is it a pen, or is it a convenient combination of plastic, metal, and ink? When is it not a pen? When did it first become a pen? In his infuriatingly pedantic way, he started by addressing the views of his predecessors. So, since I am following in his footsteps, I shall also pedantically address the views of his predecessors. Many of his predecessors, the so-called pre-Socratics, believed that existence could be reduced to material. Ultimately, the only real things were material. Others, however, saw that there must be more than just matter to explain the order and structure of what they saw abundantly apparent around them. A tree, for instance, is not just matter, it is matter with a particular order and structure. The orderly patterns that they saw were referred to as form, and the form needed to be combined with the matter to make a thing what it is. This first introduction to form to matter leads to a conundrum for the modern physicist. The physics does not know what to do with information or form. What equations or laws can possibly encompass the orderly pattern and structure that we call a tree? Maybe, though, we are not being fair to the poor physicist. Trees, after all, are part of biology. Let us consider some physical thing, like, say, a cloud. Now, with a cloud, a physicist can talk about laws of temperature, pressure, humidity, condensation, light scattering, and so on. But these laws, no matter how correct, cannot capture the thing that every two-year-old recognizes and marvels at. If you push the physicist, he would probably eventually claim that a cloud is really nothing. There is matter obeying certain laws of thermodynamics. The state and position of that matter is a result of random impersonal forces and does not really constitute a thing as such. We classify a particular result of those laws as a cloud for convenience. It is a cloud in name only. Ultimately, all of the form and pattern we see in the world is an accident of the laws of physics. The fundamental laws and fundamental particles are all that we have. All of the objects that we identify in the world are happy accidents of the fundamental structures. Take the sun. We might consider it a source of heat and life-giving source of growth to our plants. We might consider it a spherical orb of the heavens, which gives us light by which we make our way. These are happy accidents. The sun is simply an accidental result of the fundamental force of gravity, along with an unimaginable number of fundamental particles giving rise to fundamental nuclear reactions among the particles. Let's take another example, a dog. We might consider it man's best friend, a lively companion, a source of comfort and joy for our children. We might think of it as a living thing with wants and desires, instincts and thoughts. But all of these things are happy accidents. A dog is simply an organized conglomeration of matter which interacts according to the laws of physics. Of course, there seems to be order, pattern, design, and information, organs, instincts, bodily functions, shape and size, that makes a dog uniquely a dog, but really these patterns are accidents which, in an almost miraculous way, have been generated over time through self-selecting random processes of particles and fundamental laws. But you might say, we can see chemical and biological laws which give rise to the apparent order and the structure of the dog, yet even these chemical and biological laws are happy accidents. We shall count ourselves lucky that the fundamental laws and particles have apparently given rise to organic chemistry. What a bummer if we hadn't been so lucky. So a dog is a happy accident, a result of countless mindless particles simply bumping around according to laws of physics. The modern scientist, who is consistent in his belief in matter, force, and motion, sees the structure and form all around us as reducible to a handful of fundamental laws. They necessarily deny that our everyday observation and experience reveal true forms. They necessarily deny that there is any intention or meaning to the structures that we see, or that we can learn meaningful things from them. In this, the modern scientist is not alone. In fact, the modern scientist is about 2,700 years out of date, because the perspective was, more or less, the purely materialistic perspective of many of the predecessors of Aristotle. Aristotle recognized the consequences of the perspective of the materially minded pre-Socratics. I think he saw the ultimate meaninglessness of it all. He may not have understood the modern physics and the chain of modern physicist and the chain of reasoning that leads the modern scientist to explain things in terms of physics, but he saw the implication quite clearly and rejected them. Aristotle saw the need for form. Matter was not enough, and the form he was talking about was not the laws of physics. Form was the structure and information and internal order that gave a thing an identity. The form of the sun is hot and spherical, for instance. The form of a dog is more complex, but it includes its shape and size, its ability to eat, grow, and reproduce, its general behavioral character. To identify the form is to identify what a thing is. There is, however, a very serious problem in defining form in this way for a dog, a problem that the form of the sun does not have. The form of a dog seems to change. Let me explain by considering a different example of a living thing that shows this problem very explicitly. the classic example of the butterfly. The butterfly begins as an egg. Later it becomes a caterpillar. Then it changes into a pupa or in a cocoon. Then finally it becomes a butterfly. What then is the form of a butterfly? The problem is that living things are changing. Not only are the size and shape changing, but so are things like eating, growth, and reproduction. The egg and pupa do not eat, but the caterpillar does. Only the butterfly reproduces, but the butterfly does not grow. Further, the instincts and behaviors change completely. The activity and behavior of each of the stages is radically different. So if we are going to define what a butterfly is by its structure, shape, size, organization, behavior, etc., we are a little stuck. To solve this problem, Aristotle realized that more than form and matter are necessary to know what a living thing is. Change is part of the equation, and if you have change, the natural question becomes, change toward what? At this point, it seems that there are two possible answers. The first answer, the answer of the materialist, is that change is toward nothing. It is just change. All change is the impersonal interactions of forces and matter according to the laws. Thus we see change. It is cyclical. It is natural. But it is ultimately pointless. It just goes. There is no end or goal. The butterfly exists to make eggs. The eggs exist to make caterpillars. The caterpillars exist to make pupa. Pupa exists to make butterflies. There is no goal in life, only transformation. Life is ultimately for the purpose of, well, life. Answer two is that life is not, first and foremost, cyclical, but it is linear, with a beginning and an end. The end is the goal toward which the creature is striving. To fulfill this destiny is what it is for. Aristotle shrewdly opted for the second answer. The reason I suspect is that there is an important implication in the second answer, namely a destiny. The implication is that there is a purpose or goal for each and every creature. There is a direction toward which the living thing is striving. There is an undeniable intentionality in the creature, or meaning and purpose for each living thing. This direction, or end, the Greeks called telos. To explain by way of example, Aristotle would claim that the goal of a butterfly is to become an adult butterfly and exist doing butterfly activities. Its various stages are part of the process through which it achieves its telos. The adult state is the telos of the butterfly. However, it is very important to realize that the goal is not achieved at a single point in time, or in a particular shape, or in a particular age. No, it is the activity of being an adult butterfly that accomplishes its telos. The telos, or goal of the butterfly, is to do adult butterfly-ish things to the best of its ability. Now, maybe I have painted a picture of telos versus no telos too simplistically. I suppose that both purposeless change and purposeful change may somehow be combined. I don't know. Even if that were the case, then there is at least some purposeful change involved, and some purposeful change is much different than none at all. It seems to me that we have a pretty fundamental choice before us, especially with regard to us as humans. Either we have some sort of goal and an end, or we do not, and the implications are pretty huge. Consider the position of those for whom all change is purposeless. It was well depicted in a University of Oregon alumni magazine that I recently got, in which the cover had a picture of a small monkey and the headline, "What makes us human?" The answer apparently was given by some molecular biologists who were studying monkey DNA. The mere idea that we could discover the answer to the question, "What makes us human?" through molecular biology shows a thoroughgoing materialistic perspective. The choice of the materialist, that we do not have a goal, is ultimately, I believe, a choice for freedom and autonomy, but it is belied by experience. It feels as if this option allows us the freedom to choose our own ends and goals. We are no longer constrained to a specific telos, not of our own choosing. It is the ultimate freedom to define ourselves, but in that very desire to define ourselves, we find the lie of perfect autonomy. The fact is that everyone wants to be something. Who wants to be an insignificant person without reason or purpose? Even the staunchest materialist feels the need to find significance by convincing others of the meaninglessness of it all. As much as we might like to think of ourselves as free of an imposed telos, we will never be free of our natural desire to find meaning. Thus, our own nature to desire to have meaning tells us that we are not completely autonomous. We cannot simply deny our nature and make our own way. In the biological world, we also feel the emptiness of the materialist choice. We can claim that there is no proper and right end of a tree, for instance. Then, why distinguish between a healthy tree and a sick one? A large leafy tree has equal status with a scrawny, diseased tree with but a few leaves. If we look over our landscape of blackened, burned trunks from a fire, we have a sense that all is not as it should be. Part of that, of course, is the personal loss of the sense of beauty, but just as much comes from the sense that the trees and the surrounding flora and fauna have not been allowed to achieve their end of living. Thus, implicitly, we understand that there is an end to the life of a tree, and we can recognize it easily. As a result of these contradictions in the materialist view, when it comes to a choice between a world full of goals and a world full of randomness and material, I side with Aristotle. Okay, at this point, maybe it is time to recap and then indicate where I'm going with the rest of this talk. I have argued that biological creatures are things which are comprised of matter, atoms and molecules if you like, or of form, the structure, order, and pattern, and of a telos, the goal or end of that creature's existence. Human beings, by extension, must have matter, form, and telos. The alternative perspective of the materialist I have claimed is not viable. The question that I would like to pursue now, which interested Aristotle mightily, was what man's telos is. What is the end of man? What does it mean to be a human being? To examine this question, I would like to make some Aristotle-like observations. Specifically, I would like to look at how animals age as a way of examining their telos, and then compare it to the aging of humans. As a disclaimer, I am not a biologist. My observations are not those of an expert. So please correct me if I have misrepresented the situation. Let's return to dogs. Dogs show marked changes from conception to adulthood. However, those changes slow down considerably once they reach adulthood. For most of the adult life of a dog, there is hardly any change. For instance, dogs maintain their looks until they die. Some dogs do get a little gray hair around their muzzle, but it is not particularly noticeable. You cannot guess by looking at a dog the dog's age. Their behavior and physical abilities are also fairly stable. Even an old dog will bark and run vigorously at the approach of an intruder or squirrel. It is true that they calm down, slow down, and sleep longer as they age, but a 7-year-old lab and a 2-year-old lab can still run pretty nearly the same speed. Despite the adage, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, the opposite is true. They may have some decreased memory, but they can learn new tricks and enjoy doing so. Lastly, with regard to the ability to reproduce, dogs do not go through menopause. It is true that due to disease, older pregnancies have higher risk, but they can still have puppies. I'm not trying to say that dogs do not show any signs of aging. Clearly, they do. What I am saying is that the aging process is very minimal in comparison to human aging. Other mammals show similar features. Horses, like dogs, do age, but they don't exhibit the same kind of frailty in old age as humans. Most of the changes in a horse are internal rather than external. When it comes to birds, reptiles, and crustaceans, there is a similar progression. The animal reaches its adult stage and remains fairly stable physically. It is interesting to me to note that certain types, such as lobsters, turtles, and some terns, do not show any sign of aging at all. Turtles and lobsters simply get bigger and bigger. They die of disease or are killed by predators. A particular kind of tern actually increases its annual survival rate as it ages. Creatures such as fish and insects typically have specific life cycles like that of a butterfly. I don't know if you could call it aging so much as progressing in stages. Each stage leads to the final adult stage. Now consider human aging. Humans age significantly. There are very visible external changes, such as skin wrinkles, balding, and graying hair. Internal changes are also rather marked: loss of muscle tone, endurance, healing, and susceptibility to illness and disease, to name a few. At around 40 or 50, nearly all of us suffer some vision loss. Hearing loss is also not uncommon. Most of us can guess someone's rough age just by looking at them. Despite my resolute belief to the contrary, I can't seem to keep up with the younger players on the soccer field. Reproductively, also, there are changes. Women go through menopause, and our libido tends to wane beyond a certain age. One could argue that we are simply more keenly aware of our aging because we are experiencing aging ourselves. Or perhaps we are just more perceptive with regard to human aging since we experience it and it is significant in our culture. Perhaps a vet may have a different, more informed view. I don't know. But it is remarkable that at least some animals do not age at all. Further, I think it is interesting that our general experience is that the aging of animals appears very different to us, even though some dog breeds show some minimal graying in their fur. It is nowhere near as pronounced as the very distinct graying, balding, and wrinkling of humans. What, though, is the significance of this difference? As we are examining the goal or end of a human being, simple observations such as these of the biological world suggest that the end of human life is not likely physical maturity. Biologically, it makes no sense to say that a human being has reached its goal upon becoming an adult physically. If that were the case, then we have to wonder why we live into old age when we are physically deteriorating. Why do humans become incapable of reproduction? If physical prowess is the end of human life, then I think that the last 30 or so years of human life become somewhat meaningless. Thus, I think that physical existence and maturity is not the goal and purpose for a human being, and this contrasts with the telos of other creatures. So what then? Aristotle's answer to this question is that our telos is related to our rationality. Humans are uniquely endowed with language and rationality. Aristotle took this to mean that the telos of human existence was accomplished by the exercise of our rational faculties. Even if you did not like my biological argument previously, it is hard to argue with this line of thinking. It would be strange if our telos was completely unrelated to our most distinguishing feature. The same thing is picked up by Thomas Aquinas in his discussion of the last end of man in the Summa Theologica. There, Aquinas equates ultimate fulfillment with the intellectual contemplation of the divine essence, whatever that means. The key point is that man's true purpose is primarily through the use of his intellect. While it is true that our intellect is unique among all the creatures of the earth, let us probe this conclusion a little further. To do so, let us look at how our intellect changes with time, as we did earlier with our physicality. Clearly, there is development of the intellect of the child. There have been a number of famous examinations of the development of the mind of a child. As the child ages, different abilities are manifested. By the time we reach adulthood, however, our minds are fully developed and our abilities have peaked. One might argue, then, that our telos is in the continual activity and use of our intellectual faculties to the best of our ability. After all, the end of the butterfly and dog, Aristotle thought, was in the continual activity of being the best adult butterfly and dog possible. There are problems, though, with this perspective. From a purely biological perspective, it seems to me that human mental faculties and mental energy also decline as we age. The fact that our memories fail us in old age is the butt of 1,000 jokes. But that is only part of it. There is an intellectual energy which seems to decline as we age. Personally, I find it harder to concentrate for long periods of time than when I was younger. Anecdotally, when I was an undergrad studying mathematics, it was explained to me that, as a matter of history, most of the great mathematicians had their breakthroughs by the age of 25. Further, it was pointed out that if you don't have some great mathematical work by then, you are likely doomed to a career in mediocrity. Thus, just as with physical prowess, it makes little sense that the goal of humanity is the expression of a faculty that deteriorates over time. Even if my argument on the deterioration of our mental faculties is weak, which I admit, there is still the fact that the use of mental faculties are a means to an end, not an end in itself. Most of us do not find fulfillment purely from the use of our mental faculties. If we did, then wouldn't we try to spend our days memorizing and solving difficult problems? Sudoku might be the highest form of human activity. No, we use our mental faculties for a purpose rather than simply thinking. If this is the case, then rationality cannot be the end and goal of human life. Rationality is a key and unique aspect of being human. But the question remains, what is the purpose toward which our rationality is directed? At this point, our biological inquiry fails us. We cannot look to biology for clues about how to find the end toward which our intellect is directed. We must look to the mind itself. One avenue to explore would be the conclusions of those who came before us. Surely others have thought about thinking. Since Aristotle has been my theme so far, it would be fitting to begin with him. As far as I can tell, Aristotle sees the goal of our rationality to be the proper functioning of a society or city-state in his context. In other words, as rational animals, our highest calling is to rationally form a society and live within it according to our proper station in this society. This answer has some followers today. Those who strive to solve our problems through the proper social or political organization can be seen to be followers of Aristotle, at least in a sense. In this view, man becomes most human when the state has enabled an ideal environment, one in which he can contribute to the health of the society and so fulfill his destiny. The most recent version of this perspective has centered around a Marxist statist ideology, but this ideology has resulted, either directly or indirectly, in the murder of over 100 million people in the 20th century. Marxist ideology has shown itself as a failure. Nor is there a likely modification of Marxism that will accomplish the desired goal of human fulfillment. The tendency is always towards totalitarianism and horrible repression. What other answers have been given besides Aristotle's? One other popular answer is some form of hedonism, such as that found in Mill's utilitarianism. The goal of human existence is to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. To accomplish this, we must carefully apply our rationality within the context of our society. I think everyone feels the pull of this answer, but most of us also recognize its inherent problems. We intuit that the pursuit of some desires are not good for us, no matter how pleasurable. Further, our attempts to satisfy our desires is bound ultimately to fail. Living for pleasure, we perpetually strive for satisfaction. With every success, the pleasure quickly passes, and we feel the need for more. For the most part, those who adopt this perspective do not really see it as a goal of human existence. They deny that human beings have a goal and see it simply as a desirable path to follow. I have only given a cursory glimpse at these answers, and there are undoubtedly many other answers that have been given that I cannot take up. But it is not my purpose to give a comprehensive survey or a comprehensive critique of these various answers. Instead, I would like to take a different approach. I would like to abandon the sages of the past and examine the situation through everyday observations as we did before. Before we looked at various distinctives of our biology to examine what our telos might be, now I would like to look at various distinctives of our rationality and how it is used to see what its telos might be. We use our rationality and intellect to learn. All men, by nature, desire to know, says Aristotle in the first line of Metaphysics. Learning, then, seems to be a likely path to explore. There are many facets of our intellect that we use to learn: remembering, calculating, analyzing, deducing, organizing, inducing, observing, listening, and reading. None of these seem to be the end of our rationality. They all seem to be directed to learning and knowing. This further supports the point that our intellect is to learn. But can we not ask, what is the point of learning? Do we learn simply for the sake of learning, because learning is somehow an intrinsic good? I recall hearing that view in a slightly modified form when I was studying physics. There were the purest researchers who did research for the sake of promoting knowledge and furthering mankind's borders. Then there were those applied people who were always seen as sort of mercenary in their pursuit of some technological or economic advance. In that context, there was a sense that the purists may have been on the right track. There is also a vague feeling that a similar contrast exists between those who pursue education for the pure pursuit of knowledge over and against those who go to school for filthy lucre. Nevertheless, for most of us, and in nearly all other cases, we learn for the purpose of using that knowledge. Students and parents typically complain about those subjects that students never use. There may be wide disagreement about what use means, but most people recognize that learning something just for the sake of learning something makes little sense other than being pleasurable. So then, what do we use our knowledge for? Primarily, we use our knowledge to make judgments and decisions toward action. Perhaps then the goal of our intellect is to make good decisions. If we reflect, we can see that learning is only part of making good decisions. We use what we know, true, but we also remember, calculate, analyze, deduce, organize, induce in the process of making decisions. Thus, it seems as if a lot of our natural intellectual abilities are oriented toward making good decisions for action. Further, we can consider, like we did with our other competencies, how our decision-making abilities change as we age. Babies are practically incapable of making decisions. Toddlers begin to develop the ability of deciding, but they are much more inclined to simply do as their elders tell them. They trust those around them to guide their decision-making. Granted, they can be stubborn if their desires conflict with their instructions, but for the most part, toddlers do as they're instructed. As children age, they clearly develop their discernment and decision-making ability. For instance, teenagers start to reason, weighing the views of parents and authorities with that of their friends and their experiences. But I am not sure that anyone would say that teenagers are particularly skilled at making good decisions. They rely heavily on social circles and social fears for their cues. Behaviors taught by a wiser parent remain, but do not necessarily dominate. They have not developed quite enough of a moral sensibility to treat others well unless there is strong social encouragement. They have intelligence. They are using that intelligence to learn the lessons of life, but lack experience. They lack wisdom. As young adults, we continue to learn by forming a worldview. This becomes essential for making good decisions. We rely on it as a building block to provide the background for our judgments, to decide what is of value, what is good, and what evil. As we age as adults, what happens to our decision-making ability is, to me, quite striking. I find it interesting that judgment is unlike both physical and intellectual vitality. It does not seem to decrease, but to improve over time. As people age, they continue to gain experience. They continue to develop their worldview. In most cultures, old age has been highly respected rather than feared or devalued. As people age, they tend to become more wise. Not all do, you might retort. That is certainly true. Some adults seem to become even more foolish, but that is against expectations. If we see an older person who behaves irresponsibly like a child, we feel that somehow they are missing something in life. We feel pity, like something has gone wrong. What may have been excused or overlooked in a young person is condemned in the older person because they should know better. Thus, in contrast to intelligence and physical ability, an ability to make good decisions seems to increase as we age. So, where are we? First, I argued along the same lines as Aristotle that what a thing is can only be fully accounted for by its material, its form, and its telos. The material accounts for the physical stuff of a thing. The form accounts for the structure, pattern, organization of a thing. A man, for instance, has various physical capabilities and various organs in certain places which do certain things. He thinks and speaks. All of these many very complicated parts constitute the form of man. Finally, because the form of living creatures change, a full accounting for a living creature requires a purpose or goal, what completes and fulfills a creature. I then went on to discuss the telos of mankind. I suggested that it cannot be found in physicality. Man is not completed or fulfilled by physical achievement. We do not judge one human to be a better human than another by means of physical prowess. I also suggested that mental activity in itself is not the goal of man. We do not believe that we are fulfilled by simply exercising our intellect. our intellect is exercised for a purpose. Lastly, I suggested that while the intellect is a key aspect of our telos, it is directed toward the goal of making good decisions. If this is the case, then humans are fulfilled and completed by making good decisions. I suspect at this point, most of you will be recognizing that my conclusion has a large gaping hole. I have argued that making good decisions is the goal, but I have not said anything about what good is. Furthermore, you may have noticed that I have been speaking about the goal of human life without mentioning anything about God or the Bible. This must be a rather glaring omission, considering that God has made the promise to us of life beyond death. The end goal of man must certainly include the afterlife. Have I completely missed the boat? There is a method, however, in my madness. First, my topic has been, what have I learned? Prior to working at Gutenberg, I knew that eternal life was man's telos, though I may not have put it in those terms. Thus, I don't think I could claim that this is something that I have learned. Second, my topic has been looking at my experience of reading and thinking about Aristotle. Aristotle had enormous advantages in his pursuit of this topic. He had a rich history of lively discussion. He lived in a culture that valued this examination. He also had a prodigious intellect. He did not, unfortunately, have the teachings of the Israelites. In fact, he lived centuries prior to Jesus' clear teaching on eternal life. So in sticking to my Aristotelian theme, I have not addressed the promises of the Bible. Third, my approach has followed, for the most part, the style of Aristotle, an examination of our experience to understand who and what we are. It has been philosophical rather than exegetical, theological, or religious. For these reasons, then, I have looked at being a human being using Aristotle as my starting point. But I do think, interestingly, that the view I have presented fits extremely well with the biblical view in general. Let me explain. First off, the stories and exhortations of the Bible are largely about who God is. Another repeated theme is how we are to relate to Him and how we are to relate to each other. In some cases, the Bible lays out these themes fairly explicitly. But in most cases, especially in the Old Testament, God takes His chosen people through various experiences and uses those experiences to bring them to faith. God does not say to Abraham, "Confess these words and you will find favor with me." No, He says, "Choose well. Make good decisions of obedience and act on them." That is faith. The faith that God requires is acts of obedience, acts of loving kindness, and trusting God to fulfill His promises. In other words, God wants His children to make good decisions. He has instructed us over and over what those good decisions look like. When Israel makes a poor decision, God warns them and, if necessary, disciplines them. God, who created human beings, knows what He made us for and has tailored His instruction toward that end. And there is a second way in which Aristotle's perspective agrees with the Bible. Salvation is not a one-time snapshot moment in our lives. There are no magic words or thoughts or even single acts which will automatically and forever qualify us for the kingdom of God. We work out our salvation our whole lives. The Bible exhorts us to persevere and to finish the race. These sentiments only make sense in the context of lifelong activity. Compare this picture with Aristotle's view of telos. For him, creatures, including humans, are fulfilled in the continual activity of being what they are designed to be. Here on earth, we are designed to be creatures who continually make good decisions by acting out obedience and love. So while I admit that my examination of being a human being did not explore what good decisions are, although I think we could make a lot of progress in that direction using the same techniques, it did come up with a view which fits extremely well with the Bible. God has revealed Himself to be someone who wants us to choose well, and He expects us that to be a lifelong endeavor. Nevertheless, you might ask, what is the point of this little excursion into philosophy? If the answers are well addressed in the Bible, is not God's revelation to be preferred to anything we as humans can discover through our own feeble attempts? To answer this last question, a question which, by the way, exercised the wits of numerous scholars of the medieval and Renaissance periods, I would like to say something very briefly about knowing. Knowing is far more than intellectual assent. It is not simply saying some words. It is tied to how we live and act. Our knowledge can have different levels of commitment and importance to us. Some things we say we know, but they do not impact our lives in any meaningful way. Other knowledge, however, we have no words for, and yet it has the profoundest impact on every thought and action. I am convinced that the deeper that knowledge and belief have penetrated into us, the more it shapes our thoughts and lives. I am also convinced that the way that knowledge and belief become second nature is through the continued experience of what I call fittedness. By fittedness, I mean that sense that differing ideas, observations, experiences, and beliefs all fit together in a coherent narrative. If there are outlying claims or beliefs that do not fit with others, we are uneasy. But if they fit, we become more grounded and confident in our beliefs. As a tutor at Gutenberg, I have realized that secular culture has many parts that do not fit together. Much of Christian culture, unfortunately, also has parts that are hard to fit together. We who live to varying degrees in these cultures are subject to the fractured nature and competition of these many parts. As an example, as a physics student, there were assumptions and belief about materialism and what a thing is that were out of touch with my Christian convictions. For the most part, I ignored these problems, but they nagged at the back of my mind. I was somewhat nervous about the discrepancies that I lived with and was afraid to pursue them. But I have learned something profoundly important at Gutenberg College, more important even than Aristotle's view on man's telos. I have learned that ideas do fit together. I have learned that I need not fear taking on the challenges of competing ideas. With regard to this particular idea of Aristotle, my thinking about materialism and human purpose have fallen into agreement. I have gained a freedom to believe more firmly in the view of the Bible. An examination of the natural world and of humans fits extremely well into the view that the Bible promotes. These sorts of correspondences and connections are particularly meaningful to me. It is no happy accident that the Bible agrees with what nature tells us. It is the result of the design of the Creator. While it is true that I believe, I still lack belief. But the more I find a fittedness associated with the biblical worldview, the more grounded I become. So the method in my madness is this. We are made for knowing and making good decisions. Our nature tells us this. The Bible agrees. My hope, and the point of this talk, is that you can come to see this as well, that another small piece of the picture fits in place, that you will have the hope and confidence to continue to put pieces into place for yourselves, that in the process, your faith is ever so slightly deepened and made more real to you, that the truth of the biblical worldview is strengthened in the midst of a fractured world. Thank you. Okay, questions?
My question is about how you transitioned from the one to the other and what it looked like to be in your field. How did you work with telos and meaning as you worked in the field you worked in?
I think that's that basically when I was going to school at the University of Oregon and also as I continued on doing research at the University of Oregon and pursuing physics, for the most part, those questions were completely separated. What is a human being was answered in a Christian context, and what is a human being in physics was not really addressed, but it was assumed. It was just sort of an underlying feel that everybody sort of promoted and gave you. It's sort of like, well, this is physics, this is everything there is. So for the most part, I didn't really put them together. And I think it wasn't until coming to Gutenberg and continuing to study and think and read stuff with all of you guys and that I started to be able to think about the assumptions that I was given as a physicist and the assumptions that were sort of adopted by me. And it was just sort of a slow, very, very slow process of finding a little point where, well, that's kind of strange, or that's interesting, or wow, I never really thought of things that way. That's pretty radical. And these very, very slow insights and a continual churning of them over time eventually brought me to the position that I'm in now. So a lot of it was just the stuff that I learned at Gutenberg College.
Do you think that that is a, that would be, what is the addition you would say to physics to help it grow into a field that allows for maybe less materialism and more other?
What is the addition to physics?
Yeah. Is it like further discussion, more philosophical discussion?
Yeah, it was looking at writings of people other than physicists, exploring questions that the physics community never explored, writings and ideas and thoughts that physicists, frankly, could care less about. So it was the addition of that new information that made that possible for me, and interacting with others on those issues as well.
I have a question about Aristotle.
Telos.
I don't know if my question makes sense, and it might be a little like nitpicky, but I'm just wondering, why does Aristotle think that the adults, like say the butterfly example, the adult stage is the telos and not just like all of it being a butterfly? Or is that just not answering his question? Because he's asking what being a butterfly is.
Well, the way Aristotle talks about it, I think, and again, I'm not really an Aristotle scholar, I've just microed a lot of Aristotle books, so. He talks about it in terms of things which can become what they are designed to become, and things which are in the process of being the thing that they are supposed to be. The first one, the English word that is associated with that idea, I think, is potentiality. And the second one is actuality. Those are the words that people use, translate. But I think the idea is that there's a sense in which this thing has the possibility to become what it fully is, but it's not there yet. So it's possible, maybe somebody else knows better than me, that the earlier stages are still part of Aristotle's telos. I don't know. I don't know enough of his writings about animals and stuff like that, and telos and things like that, to know for sure. I'm gleaning that and making a judgment on that. So it's possible I'm mistaken on that. But I think he definitely has this sense of the potential to become and the actual being and becoming the thing that it was designed to be. I don't know. Does that answer your question or not?
Yeah, I think so. It was just this little...
Yeah, no, it is an interesting thing.
How does that change how you teach physics?
Well, one way it changes how I teach physics is that I don't really teach physics anymore.
Do you see a value in physics interacting with the liberal arts curriculum?
Mostly what I teach, and I think is probably the most valuable thing given the amount of time and effort and what we can do, is to teach people about science and about physics, and about the assumptions that it makes, and how that impacts the way we think about things, and how it impacts how we think about knowledge, and how it impacts the way we think about what it means to be a human being, and those sorts of things. It seems to me that those are the things which are most valuable to teach, given the framework that we have here at Gutenberg College, for instance. I think, personally, I have gained a lot from the practice of physics as an undergrad and graduate student in terms of my ability to solve problems and to interact with complex information and to look for patterns. And so there is a skill of knowing, it seems to me, that is worth honing and is very valuable and is, I think, is squarely within a liberal arts tradition that can be gained in a physics curriculum. And of course, it is interesting. and you can use it for work and things of that sort like that. But I have gained a lot in terms of the skills that I gained in that process of being a physicist. And I think that that would be valuable to pass on to students. It's just really difficult in the context that we have at Gutenberg College to really have enough time and focus with people's different abilities and backgrounds and stuff to really work on that particular skill, unfortunately.
Could I ask a question related to that? I think if you were to go back into the physics laboratory, how would this change in your thinking impact that?
That's a really difficult question, partly because I can't imagine myself going back into the physics laboratory, because most of the kinds of things in a physics laboratory that would be available for me to do are things that I would really just not be interested in. So I think the biggest impact that it would have on me in going back to a physics laboratory is that I wouldn't be interested in the subject matter that they were talking about. There are some subjects that are really keenly interesting to me of more of a theoretical nature. And I think that if I had the energy, I would like to read further, and if I had like people that I could interact with on those sorts of things, I would like to read further, especially about the beginnings of the 20th century, physics in the beginnings of the 20th century, and explore what happened there and whether or not they made all the right decisions. And I think that they didn't make all the right decisions, and I think that would be something that would be keenly interesting to me to pursue on a theoretical level. I don't know if I have the ability to do that or the energy to do that, but that would be something that I would pursue if I could. But probably in the physics laboratory, given where I am right now and my age and my interest, I just don't think I would do it. Not that it's not something that people really enjoy doing and they could do, but I probably wouldn't do it.
I was going to ask Charlie about this last night, but maybe you can address this, or maybe he wants to. I think he mentioned at one point scientist needs to be virtuous, if I'm correct. And it seems related to some of what you've been talking about, but I'm wondering if you can expand on that, the need for virtuous.
I can tell you what my answer is. I don't know exactly what Charlie was thinking about. It seems like knowing, the process of knowing and coming to know things is a skill. It is a difficult skill to develop. We all have some level of skill in our ability to know, but part of that skill is using information that we have, seeking information, and being able to try and fit that together in a pattern or an organization where all the information actually fits together well. We're not ignoring some part, we're not ignoring some other part, we are not trying to come to a conclusion because of our wants and desires and will. And whether we like it or not, our will and wants and desires does work its way into our skill of knowing. And so it seems to me that the more your will and your decision making is aimed at truth and what's right and being fair to all the various information that is coming to me, wanting truth more than wanting to get a particular answer, those sorts of things like that, those are characteristics of a virtuous person, a person who wants truth, a person who is fair-minded in the evaluation of information and the evaluation of data. And I think it's really, really important to develop that desire for truth, that desire for fair-mindedness in one's pursuit of knowledge. And so virtue, I think, comes in largely into that way of knowing. I don't know if that's what Charlie was thinking, but then.
Well, first, I would agree with everything you said, Chris. The context I was using it in is traditionally science wanted to separate fact from value and only deal with facts and not things of value. And so a specialized education, in fact, in science is going to cut you off from ever addressing questions such as ethics. So, for example, should there be limits to science? Well, science would never ask that question. Of course there are no limits to science. We're going to investigate everything. So my interest in those comments last night was science, and the specialty of science, wants to cut off any kind of questioning or any kind of investigation of ethics or morals. That's not science. And my point was simply that it's one thing to do your specialty of science, but a human being is a lot of other things. So, for example, you're a citizen in a country. Well, the founding fathers said this experiment won't work if there aren't virtuous citizens. My point was, no science curriculum is going to teach you that, so where are you going to get an education in what it means to be a virtuous citizen? So that was the kind of issue I had in mind. And so, again, my claim was that a liberal arts curriculum does both.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Charlie's explanation of a science education is exactly what I got. Never took any courses, like Charlie was saying, in any kind of ethics or virtues or anything like that. It was all problem sets. I had a lot of problem sets. I wrote one paper as an undergrad. I wrote zero papers as a... No, I wrote some for publications, but... Okay, well, thanks, everybody.